I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Michigan State University has set its budget for the new fiscal year.
Well, it's always a difficult time when you do budgets because there's a lot of balancing act that needs to occur. I'm really pleased that the budget included an extraordinary 7% savings in energy. Who could have guessed it? And that really is a tribute to Satish Gupta and his work with folks in IPF over a period of time, even though our demand is going up. I also am pleased that the healthcare costs are going to get about 5%. We've averaged, I think, below the national average 8 of the last 10 years. And that really is, again, a tribute to our employees who, together with us through the healthcare coalition and through the faculty healthcare committee, really worry about providing appropriate benefits but still cost-effective benefits for our faculty, staff, and retirees.
That's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. The university also set tuition rates for the 17-18 school year. You can read all the pertinent details at msutoday.msu.edu.
Tuition is always a difficult challenge. To offset tuition, the average tuition did raise financial aid about 4.5%. Part of the budget discussion under the financial aid was a continuation of something we called Spartan Advantage, which has been in place for about 7 years. And it does essentially what the new Michigan program does, because if you're at a certain income level, then we essentially provide tuition dollars out of our own financial aid, the university-generated financial aid that's above anyone who has Pell. You know, the challenge for us, I commend the University of Michigan. It's a terrific program. It does model ours, although we got very little credit for that along the way. And part of that's because they were able to do something at a pretty dramatic figure of $63,000 family income. Our median family income is $73,000. So while we've had the Spartan Advantage program in place to provide free tuition for Michigan citizens, we just are not able to do that for almost half of our class. So the spirit's there, the program models that, but it's just not economically feasible, particularly with the University of Michigan and having more dollars per student from the state, and also because they have so many more out-of-state students. Dave Bilek did modeling for the board. It's in the presentation we did to the board, which shows really the dramatic effect of those two variables on what we could do for tuition if we essentially jettisoned in-state students in favor of out-of-state students. But that's not consistent with our mission. It would permit us to move the income level for Spartan Advantage, but it wouldn't be consistent with providing a Big Ten quality, world-recognized reputation value to as many students as possible in Michigan. And so it's a really difficult sort of balancing act. We did do something a bit different that is also, as I'm reading the newspaper, a little bit harder to understand. We have been working with a national program that's also been looked at by Deloitte to figure out ways of increasing academic standards and also at the same time increasing graduation rates, particularly for those students who come from the most vulnerable backgrounds. And it's a world of ands: high standards, higher standards, increasing graduation rate. And we've been doing it through a lot of data analytics, sharing ideas with institutions who are part of this project across the country. And the numbers are changing dramatically because the biggest cost of a degree is if you don't finish. If you also look at the data that we provided that should be up on the website for the background that I presented at the board, you'll see, I think quite surprisingly, if you think about the income distribution of our students versus those of the University of Michigan, we're within 1 or 2 percentages of those students who are leaving with debt, And the average debt is almost exactly the same, even though the income levels for our students are remarkably different. But the question is, what more can we do? And through that is the sort of data analytics piece.
Michigan State's new Go Green, Go 15 campaign urges students to take an average of 15 credits per semester or complete 30 credits in their first year of study by taking summer classes. Universities have found early momentum yields higher graduation rates, less time and cost to attain a degree, and higher grade point averages.
It's counterintuitive. There's a national study being done that's in the group we're part of that says that actually taking more credits rather than less in your freshman year, even though you're the most vulnerable student, which is against everything we've been sort of teaching people and thinking about over the last as many years as I've been in higher education, sort of ease people in, shows that when you do that, you actually have performance that's less than predicted. And I know it's counterintuitive, and it's causing lots of consternation as I'm reading the results of our Go Green or Go 15. But it makes enormous sense because it's built on data. What's a part of that is really the following, is that you can always the key is the combination of courses that you take, not necessarily the load you take. And we also know from our work, the provost knows, that if you take a particular combination of courses, you can be one of the brightest kids in our class, or you could be a student who barely got into Michigan State, who was also bright but still barely got in. And if you take that combination of classes, you're in trouble. It doesn't matter. Whether you're in the Honors College, we just given you the biggest scholarship in the world, or whether you're somebody who's on the wait list. And so academic advising is not about credits. It's about the nature and the quality of the experiences and how they fit together. And that's really the big power of this, because it means that students could actually graduate sooner, lowering the cost, and more of them can graduate. And our experiment shows that from last fall that those students, the most vulnerable students, actually raised their persistent freshman-sophomore persistence rates. So I know it's counterintuitive. I really do. And I've gotten all these letters from academic advisors who say, over the years, I just know that. And they'll say Mary. Okay. Well, I'm sure that there's a Mary or a Joe out there for which this does not work. Okay. Students with disabilities might be an example of that, which is why we didn't raise it as block tuition. So you're not paying for more credits than you're taking. But by freezing the tuition next year, so that every student coming in next year knows they're going to pay fall 16 rates, freshmen coming in, then they can make a rational choice that isn't about worrying about what the tuition rate will be, the rate increase. And for those students who just don't want to do it, you know, we're not going to throw them out of Michigan State. Okay, this is a financial incentive to do that. If we get enough students to do that, then down the road there may be the possibility of a block tuition, which sort of makes it financially easier for people just not to worry about, so they could take even more than 15 credits, because some students are very able to do that. But it's, you know, it's feeling fascinating because it does go at our myths. And one of the things that big data does and data analytics is it is a myth buster sometimes. And that's why companies, universities, communities, even not-for-profits, are using it, because you need to continue to analyze your myths. Because sometimes those are the things that are in your barrier to doing exactly the things that you want to do. For us, it's have more students graduate, which means a lower cost of degree for them, and be more students to be more successful.
President Simon was recently at the Mackinac Policy Conference talking about how Michigan's University Research Corridor has conducted $1.2 billion in research and development in the health sciences and is a key source of talent, deliverer of care, and economic driver in Michigan. The URC is one of the nation's top academic research clusters and the leading engine for innovation in Michigan and the Great Lakes region. An alliance of Michigan State University, the University of Michigan, and Wayne State University, the URC is focused on increasing economic prosperity and connecting Michigan to the world.
Well, the URC is sort of 10 years old now, at a time when the country, Michigan was in a different place. And it really is all about attracting talent to the state, keeping talent, and attracting companies and jobs. And we were feeling, Mary Sue and I, Mary Sue Coleman, president of Michigan, that Michigan was not getting the attention it deserved, given the quality of the institutions. And everybody was talking about Boston and the Research Triangle and Pittsburgh and those kind of things. And so we decided that we would look at the power of the three sort of at that point highest classified research universities in the state. And we would benchmark those against all those other clusters. Because that way, and we'd had Anderson Economic Group do it, who was a very conservative oriented company, because that way it wasn't a university multiplier. Even though we have great people in our survey research public policy center, they have great people in their survey research public policy center. It had to be believable. And so Anderson did it, and that's the benchmarking report. And it really shows that if you add all the variables together, companies and graduates and all that kind of stuff, research dollars, we're the second most powerful innovation cluster in the country. And that's an asset for Michigan. It wasn't a political statement that other people aren't important. It's how you portray your assets, because you got to get them here first. And then the second idea was that we needed to think about sectors of the economy that were broad sectors, because you recruit to sector. You don't recruit to just simply a bunch of universities. And so we picked sector reports. And life sciences actually was the first one we looked at, because at that point in time, we had some residual of what was called the life sciences corridor, which had Wayne, Michigan State, Michigan, and Van Andel to look at core facilities necessary to really push life sciences. Now, things have changed. Drug companies left the state, lots of churn. But I think what the report shows is that we've made, in spite of that, have made steady progress. And what it's yet to show is really the collective benefit that is the research cluster developing in Grand Rapids, particularly when we open the new building, so that Van Andel can spread out and have more scientists. We can spread out and have more scientists. And that really is in partnership with Grand Valley. And that's it's a very powerful piece. And then Spectrum Health System has researchers who are really little pods and isolates. And some of those will move into the building. And we'll also put a big data analytics capacity in Grand Rapids that they currently don't have from an academic perspective. And that's going to change the slope of that curve dramatically. And so we're really looking forward to that, but that's not reflected in the report. And also in life sciences, it includes some of the issues of agriculture and food, because those are really critical to the future.
President Simon has some additional thoughts on the annual Mackinac Policy Conference's impact this year.
Well, I suppose you would describe Mackinac as networking on steroids in the old days, networking that's amped up by all this computer power today. So in some sense, if you go often enough, it feels the same. I think that if I look at my time as president through this very difficult time for Michigan, there's clearly more optimism in the face of problems that are real and have big numbers associated with them. But there's a little bit more optimism as people think about the world around them. There's less optimism in Flint. And we've collectively got to worry about that, because in the same way that no child should be left behind in that sense of an opportunity for great education, no part of our state should be left behind. And there's been a lot of effort to work in Detroit, a collective bipartisan effort. Lots of people have been made private sector investments. Grand Rapids is really growing and developing. We'd like to have a bit more of that here. But if you look at the state, you've got to be pleased that Dow says it's making a commitment to Midland, but you don't know what quite that will look like in the future. You've got the devastation in Flint that needs to be addressed in a fundamental way even before the water crisis, and now really becomes something that we all have to work on, not just over time for the children, to give them a legitimate chance to be successful and come back and make a difference in Flint, but also just the basic economic underpinnings. And so that's something we have to worry about. You know, I'm pleased that if you look at Mackinac, that it's an East and West conference now. I'm pleased that there was a good representation from people, you know, from the Traverse City area who are into entrepreneurship and development, even though there's not a big company that's there. So I think we're gradually finding ways to think about this as what happens good in somewhere benefits all of us. And I know that's really hard. And then a lot of the reports, infrastructure, roads, you know, the numbers keep climbing and the revenue doesn't. And then the final thing I think that was underlying all of that, whether it's the K-12 discussions or workforce discussions, whatever you want to, you know, every place you want to do as a topic, is that, you know, the data would suggest that there are more children living in difficult circumstances today. That doesn't bode well for the next generation. The data suggests that there will continue to be a decline of K-12 graduates by demographics that we've not offset by higher education and better education, as the Cherry Report under Governor Granholm suggested. Lots of concerns and a bit about workforce development, but also the dropout rates of the workforce that's related to the opiate epidemic. Because you can't get a job if you can't trust a drug test. And so there are lots of solutions for all of that, including how we think about community colleges and more apprenticeship, more technical programs, but also how do you get people accustomed to working? Because there's a view that people play at work but don't work as young people, or not enough of them essentially really think about what it means to be a professional at whatever you do. Because when you're working now on an automobile, you're a professional. You're a computer professional, if nothing else, right now. When you're doing very complicated work in construction, you're a professional. You may not wear a tie. My dad never wore a tie, but he always considered himself a professional. When he was working in a power plant and doing shift work, he was a professional. And he had a responsibility to learn and grow and make the plant better. And that attitude that was a part of, I guess, my generation growing up is something that people touch on in the conference as not seeing enough of. There are clearly plenty of examples of people who have it. We need more of it. We need more of it if America is going to be competitive. You know, it's not this dialogue of, gee whiz, you know, we'll trash somebody else because they're not me, or the world is going to heck in a handbasket, as you've heard over time. We just need more of it because the world's more competitive. And it's more across a lot of dimensions. So it isn't just we need more people who do trades at the expense of more people who do data analytics. We've got to have both for the future. And unfortunately, I think the dialogue, because it's always in silos and it mirrors what's in the media. You know, and I keep telling people here, we're a world of ants. You know, we're working with community colleges now on a certificate program in food safety, you know, because we need that. And hopefully some of those people decide to get a bachelor's degree. But if they don't, they're going to be well-trained for a lifetime. Because everybody has to be a lifelong learner now, more than ever. And continue to hone their skills, because the technologies that people are using in cars now will change. And people have to grow and know how to do that. And that's the part we keep sort of understanding at one level and not being prepared to argue for it another, because we're always trading one aspect of a budget against another. You know, or one political view about who's crying the loudest about workers against another. It really is this network, this ecosystem of work and talent and passion and purpose, you know, that will move the stakes forward. So we'll see what happens. But meanwhile, we'll continue to try to be a voice for ANZ.
There wasn't a formal energy transition update this past spring on campus because, as President Simon says, MSU has transitioned from an energy transition plan to just an energy plan.
Well, I would say that we have an energy plan, not an energy transition plan, because the big focus of that was on whether we had coal or not. That was the issue. And then, you know, as we move more towards renewables. But the technology in many ways but needs to continue to develop for a place our size. And we've gotten rid of coal, so that way we've made the biggest energy transition. There's not a technology in place right now outside of nuclear that would power this on 100% renewables. And in fact, with the retiring of nuclear plants in Michigan, the renewable portfolio may take a slight decline because of replacing plants with gas, and there are just not enough windmills and solar panels. So we'll still continue towards our 15% renewable goal. It's the state goal. It's the state's goal. And we'll, I think, inch up to that. But I think mostly we're worried about the effective use of our energy and how do we reduce our energy footprint when people bring more and more devices all the time. You know, so it seems like it's a sort of a losing battle because the number of devices for a while was 2, and now somebody tells me you're bringing 7, you know, things, whatever 7 things are. From the myriad of things that kids have these days. So, and all of us are, because we're paperless, are much more energy, electricity dependent. So that's why I'm so pleased that we're able, through a whole range of things, to reduce the energy cost by 7% this year and have it at 0 for next year. It really is unheard of. So we're going to do that by very carefully sort of managing our energy production and our energy buying, at the same time continuing with things like the Better Building Challenge, which were designed to reduce the use of energy in buildings, and continue to look at ROIs on a variety of things. And we'll probably make some changes to the plant again that tries to keep it in balance, that takes full advantage of cogeneration as a very energy efficient footprint. But at the same time, recognizing that if the plant gets out of balance because you're producing too much electricity, it means you're wasting too much steam, and you have to be able to keep everything in balance. And Tatish and his team, Wolfgang Bauer, Bob Ellerhorst and his team in the plant, have really done a great job of that. And that's getting coordinated with new buildings and new approaches and fixing all the steam tunnels that we've already did, which will be, you know, that's another way of preserving energy loss or reducing energy loss. So it's the multifaceted thing, and we'll continue to work with the students as part of and faculty about all those projects. So maybe one day those solar panels that our faculty members designed, that thin piece, will actually be on our buildings. You know, it's really neat. I mean, to augment the work that we do in a more traditional plant.
In light of some of the proposed budgets in Washington, I wondered whether President Simon is concerned about federal research funding reductions.
I think there's a lot to be worried about. Indirect cost is real. It pays for heat and lights and computer time and everything else that the research enterprise does. And I think that's you know, an easy thing because people don't think it hurts you, but it really does. It would put an initial cost burden on the institutions and their faculty. And America needs to be at the forefront of this basic understanding. I mean, if you look around the world and you think there's an arms race because North Korea's building something, it's a missile, worry about their cyber attacks. Worry about the billions of dollars and of investment in China to take the edge of fundamental research that America had all along. Worry about Russia ramping up its basic research program again. Because, quite frankly, we won all these years by being at the forefront of innovation, in addition to having a sense of a big heart and a sense of values. And we can't lose that forefront of innovation for the next generation. You're in the midst of all of this and finding a way to knock down a missile. Yeah, so this is a world of ands. It's not ors. I'm not opposed to finding something that knocks down a missile, because that's all built on technology that's already been developed. I'm for developing the next set of technology so that we won't lose in the future. And the only way you do that is by funding basic research. And you have to just believe in it, because you can't see it. You can't say that thing will cause this thing. But you can look at a space shuttle and you can work backwards from it. But you have to believe going forward. And that's what makes it hard on people to want to believe. But that's what this is about. And then educating the next generation of scientists in places like this so they continue that arc and pathway of competition. And it's part of making America the best. We can be great and not be the best. I want America to be the best. But do it with a great heart and compassion for others, but to be the best. And that's what research does. Okay? I mean, it's the pathway to being the best. So I worry about it a lot, and I worry about the effect on the next generation of scholars. Because we've got to be the best not just today, but we've got to be the best for somebody's great-grandchildren and their great-great-grandchildren. And that's, it's sort of the old adage of John Hanna and Cliff Orton, you can't eat your seed corn. Yeah, and it was true on the farm, and it's true today intellectually.
For Spartans who want to stay up to date on football and Nassar issues, President Simon says,
I would really take everybody to the Our Commitment website. We'll try to keep people informed about what's happening. It's not all new, but it's a place to put and be clearer what's happening, because if you look at all the press releases, they're looked at in isolation. And, we had a youth protection policy for a long time. We just updated. We've always been updating the Title IX policies. It's not new. We've had a victims unit in the police since 1992. They happen to, because our faculty members are active nationally, Rebecca Campbell as an example, Amy Bename, others, that we have all of our police officers trauma-informed well before this happened. And people forget about that and they take it for granted. So it's a little bit of trying to put things in perspective, but also recognizing that we're always evaluating and figuring out ways to do things better. And that isn't in response to Nassar. The website is a way of trying to make sense of all of the sound bites people are putting out there without connecting the dots at all. And so that's what that is. On the football investigation, the Jones Day report has been made public. I think it's pretty clear that Coach D'Antonio and all but one handled it appropriately, according to Jones Day. I think that, I think the system worked, our part of the system. It doesn't mean that they're guilty or innocent in a legal sense. It's not our responsibility to make that decision. It's our responsibility to collect evidence in as fairly and effectively as possible, to present that and work with the prosecutor, for the prosecutor to decide whether there's a basis for moving forward, not because she believes they're guilty, but because the judicial system appears decides that. That's America. And it's often easy to say that because this happened, they're automatically guilty, or because this didn't happen. So I think that that moved forward. I think that if you look at the national press, not the local press, who seems to be more worried about whether we're going to win or lose next year, I think people would give us relatively high marks for how it was handled. Difficult decisions, controversial, but I think, you know, it was handled straight up and by the institution, by the athletic director, by the president, by the coach. You know, and that's all you can ask for. You educate and educate and educate, which they did. But sometimes people don't listen. They may prove to be innocent. I don't know that. What I know is what we're trying to take care of Michigan State. On the Nassar issue, you know, again, there's just not a lot of new information, and if there were, I couldn't tell you. but I do believe that, as I've said in other settings, that we've cooperated with the Attorney General's office, the U.S. Attorney, all the, because this is a national issue, not simply a Michigan State issue. And it's taking an enormous amount of time. Again, the police have put a lot of energy in this. A lot of trauma-informed investigators spend a lot of time with people who have come forward. And it'll just play out. It could play out a lot faster from my perspective, but it goes at its own pace. I remind people that, for better or worse, the 2014 investigation found no violation of policy. Recommended better practice, but no violation of policy. That case was very different in context than what is coming out now. When we learn more, I think we took prompt personnel actions, and we'll continue to do what is appropriate for Michigan State. But beyond that, you know, it's as frustrating to me as it is for everybody else. I just wish that people would put dots together instead of reporting sound bites, but that's going to go on until there's a better closure on all of this.
President Simon closes our summer conversation by reminding me summer is a special time at MSU. While the university hardly slows down, the pace is a little different.
Yeah, the summer on campus has a different rhythm to it. I mean, there are little kids playing in front of Wells Hall throwing balls around because they're part of a summer youth program. We just finished 4-H Exploration Days last week. We've got all these sports camps going. We did Odyssey of the Mind earlier. So it's just a different rhythm. We'll do Grandparents U, and hopefully it won't be too hot for people to go back to relive their residence hall experience. But, yeah, so it's fun to do that. It gives you a little bit more time to, as faculty members are working in their labs and stuff, to go talk and see what they're doing and what they're thinking about, because there's just a little bit less tension about the schedule. And it's also fun to see all the new Spartans who are coming for orientation. You know, with all of their hopes and dreams, your kids were in that position a little bit ago, but you know, now they're thinking about internships and great companies they're interning with, and graduate school and jobs and everything else, and time goes really fast.
Indeed.
But, you know, it's just this kind of a rejuvenation time.
Keep up with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon at president.msu.edu. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.